Well, hi there. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, and you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3 FM. In late April of this year, the federal government announced it would make sweeping cuts to the Interim Federal Health Program, a program that provides access to health care for refugees in Canada. On May 11th, over 90 doctors occupied Member of Parliament Joe Oliveri's office, demanding that the cuts be reversed. In June, rallies took place in over 8 cities across the country. Frustrated by being ignored by the federal government and having exhausted all other means of communicating with members of parliament, physicians began disrupting news conferences hosted by members of parliament. In response to this unprecedented mobilization of the health sector, the federal government quietly backtracked on some of the cuts. As of June 30th, certain groups of refugees no longer have access to medications, nor do they have access to preventative care unless their condition is deemed a threat to public health or public safety. Here to talk with me today about the cuts and about the health sector response is Montreal activist and pediatrician Dr. Samir Sahin Hussein.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Samir, last time you were on the show back in January of 2011, we were also talking about access to care for refugees, and at that time, the Association of Quebec Pharmacists were refusing to fill prescriptions for refugees covered under the Interim Federal Health Program. At the time, they were fed up with the billing system. They were feeling that the IFHP insurance was bureaucratic and long. And you and others in Montreal and across the country had been kind of responding to that. So looking back on that time now, do you think that we could have predicted the cuts to refugee health?
I mean, retrospectively, it seems actually that, yeah, like the answer seems to be pretty clearly yes. Even at the time, I think a lot of us felt like what was happening between the Association Québécois pour les Pharmacistes and CIC was potentially kind of like a trial run by CIC to see what kind of backlash, if any, there was going to be to, in this case, putting in a system or removing a system basically where refugees wouldn't be able to have access to medications. Because if you actually look at the timeline around, actually specifically February 3rd, 2011, which was a few days after there was a temporary agreement between CIC and the AQPP, there was a House of Commons committee meeting or hearing that took place in which the representatives of the AQPP and the CIC were both invited to speak, sort of just to talk about the issues with the Interim Federal Health Program. Mm-hmm. And what's instructive, I think, I mean, it's available online, the transcript, but parts of it that are instructive in particular are interventions by certain conservative MPs who were on the committee, who basically, asked questions relating to the provisions of the IFHP and wondering whether, or asking aloud whether the provisions are too generous. So specifically, if I recall, Alice Wong, who was a member of parliament at the time from the Conservative Party, basically asked very specific questions beyond the issue even of medications. Specifically, she asked one which had to do with dental care, whether it was felt that dental care was too much coverage. Basically, I think it speaks volumes in the sense of where the Conservative Party was going from very, very, very early on, and I think that sort of in a way belied or betrayed their intentions from an early point, because at that time the PR line rather was basically that refugees should get access to the medications they're entitled to, but mm-hmm. that clearly has changed quite a lot between then and now.
Mm-hmm. Right, because I guess the main argument we're hearing from the federal government right now is that the cuts will primarily affect so-called bogus claimants, that refugees have, quote, gold-plated health cards. What are some of the things you've been saying to respond to these kinds of criticisms?
I mean, and it's actually interesting what you just said just sparked it, because the other thing that Alice Wong said in her intervention was basically the whole question of bogus refugees. She said, her quote essentially, "Do you think that your Canadian customers will appreciate that they are not subsidizing fake refugees?" Because there could be people coming to the pharmacist claiming that. So just to say, like, that was her other element, you know, aside from that, the dental point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few things. One is that the Conservative government clearly is scapegoating migrants in general by making them out to be people who are trying to cheat the system. And like you mentioned, you know, they're saying that refugees are getting gold-plated healthcare, when on that level, what seems quite clear is that that's not the case. And I think what's important for a lot of us who work within the healthcare field to recognize is that prior to the IFHD cuts coming through, many of us were already saying that the IFH program, while beneficial to a certain extent, is clearly not comprehensive or exhaustive enough. And so that the fact that the cuts came into place just make a situation much worse. But before the IFH coverage, when it was intact, was still actually not adequate for meeting the needs of that specific population. And I think the other question ends up being the whole issue, I think, with regards to quote-unquote bogus refugees is basically a way for them to justify their ideological positions, right? So they're basically, in terms of other policies that they're putting through in immigration law, they're instituting a massive crackdown on quote-unquote legal immigration. And this rhetoric is basically used to justify that. And they are able to very effectively convince people that refugees are quote-unquote exploiting the system or whatnot, when clearly for those of us who work in healthcare, we know that that's far from the truth. And we, at least those of us who have been mobilizing around these cuts, feel very strongly that anyone who, people who are living here should be treated in terms of with respect to healthcare with justice and with dignity. And I think that's the point I need to come across very clearly in the opposition to these cuts.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned just briefly the context in Canada in terms of broader immigration changes. Can you mm-hmm. just comment briefly on that context?
Sure. I think one of the more specific legislations that have come through recently is what was referred to as Bill C-31 prior to being implemented. This was called the Protecting Canada's Immigration System Act, which many of us have redubbed the Refugee Exclusion Act. It's worthwhile to actually read the points, you know, that have come through as a result of that act being enacted. But one of the most important for us from a healthcare perspective is the implementation or the modification of what are called designated countries of origin,
mm-hmm.
Where basically the modification through this act is that the Minister of Immigration can basically decide which countries get designated country of origin designation, which basically means that the Government of Canada or Citizenship and Immigration Canada feel that those countries are considered quote-unquote safe in mm-hmm. the sense that they don't produce refugees because those countries are thought to have rigorous legal systems, etc., that would allow to address and redress complaints or issues with regards to human rights that people may make. For any of us who've been, again, mobilizing around these issues, what seems clear is that there's no country that can be afforded that kind of a status. No country can claim that they are not producing refugees because we know that there's all kinds of systematic abuses that happen at a state level directed against individuals and groups of groups of people. Mm-hmm. And so to do that is completely preposterous. And with regards to the DCO specifically, it seems clearly targeted to limit the immigration of very specific groups of people, the most obvious of which seems to be Roma people from Europe. So, but also, you know, people coming in from Mexico. There's also going to be other countries that, that we suspect are going to be targeted very heavily. And so the way that that's going to factor into healthcare provision is basically that the IFHP cuts now are tiered in such a way that people coming from designated countries of origin are going to have, you know, basically much more limited, if non-existent, healthcare coverage, whereas people who aren't will have a little bit more coverage, but they still will suffer from the fact that now there's no coverage for dental procedures, for medications, for, you know, walking and mobility aids, things like that, that were previously covered under the IFHP.
So you're a pediatrician and you also work with other healthcare workers. Have you personally witnessed or heard about cases of refugees who have been affected by the cuts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're, you know, we're seeing and we're hearing all kinds of stories across the country. People, I mean, the latest one I just heard was a woman who was pregnant and ended up having an abortion because she was concerned that she wouldn't be able to afford follow-up during the pregnancy, basically pregnancy care. Obviously, women should have access to abortions. There's no question about that. But this seems to be a situation where women are being forced, in this kind of a situation where a woman is being forced to make that decision strictly based on the fact that healthcare coverage that was previously available is not going to be available anymore. There's also been situations where, you know, children who are on seizure medications are no longer able to afford it because medications are not covered under interim federal health program anymore. And so that's resulted in either, obviously, breakthrough seizures, which is a significant health risk, but also further hospitalizations and all the ramifications that have not only on the health of the child, but also on the well-being of the family. Mm-hmm. So we've been hearing these things from, you know, across the country, and it seems like things are just going to get worse. Take-home message, I think, that they're sending to people, to especially the healthcare providers, is basically that it's okay if you refuse to provide care to refugees. And I think ultimately that's often what is actually being being understood. So people are being refused. For example, in Quebec, we've heard of several stories of people who should actually be covered through the interim federal health program, who basically clinics have said, no, our understanding is that we're not supposed to provide care to you anymore. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, you know, that kind of refusal has really devastating effects when that word of mouth gets through the community, and the level of fear and precarity that creates is magnified to significant levels that are very difficult to measure, I think, and that are also very difficult to rectify, even if/when the cuts are rescinded. It'll take a while to be able to build that trust back into, you know, for people to have trust in the system, mm-hmm. To provide care that they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we've heard a lot of cases of people being turned away when in fact the DCO or safe country list isn't actually even published yet. So theoretically right now, although refugee claimants don't have access to medicines, they should all have access to conditions deemed a threat to public safety, but also to general preventative care, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the other thing, right? Is the whole question of quote unquote preventative care is very vague, and our hope would be that, you know, preventative care includes all kinds of things. It includes for sure things like vaccines, if you know, individuals and families wish that, but also regular health checkups, things like that. And I think what this is, the cuts have also resulted in is the fact that a lot of the interpretation of what's covered by the IFHP now is left to the bureaucratic level and not to the level of the healthcare providers themselves, which is obviously also not optimal in terms of care provision, because it's basically instituted another level of bureaucracy that is going to further limit the possibility of people being able to properly and freely access healthcare.
Mm-hmm. I want to switch gears for a second now and talk a little bit about the mobilization among healthcare workers. And I guess you've long organized alongside migrant justice groups around access to healthcare for people with precarious immigration status. What was it like for you to find that all of a sudden 90 doctors were occupying an MP's office and other healthcare workers were interrupting minister's speeches? What was that like?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was, in one word, it would basically be described as inspiring. I think it was a momentous occasion, you know, for healthcare providers, and specifically healthcare providers being physicians that, you know, are not typically, at least in the North American context, and particularly in the last, you know, few years / decades, are not typically regarded as being, you know, rabble-rousers or people who are sort of confronting the system. For people from that sort of field of healthcare provision coming in and, like you mentioned, taking on tactics that are very confrontational, including occupation of an MP's office in Toronto, including doing disruptions, for which the seminal disruption seemed to be the disruption of the same MP whose office was occupied, which spurred further disruptions, was incredible. And I think it speaks, though, to the level of how egregious these cuts actually are, because I think it came to the point where a lot of these physicians who have been providing healthcare for migrant and refugee populations for years, if not for decades, in certain cases, really, you know, tried to understand where the cuts are coming from, tried to go through what are considered as "quote unquote" democratic channels to have them blocked or to make sure that they don't go through, and clearly that didn't work. And so, in light of the fact that they realized that the government was forging ahead full steam with these cuts, it seemed quite clear that they had no other option but to escalate their tactics in order to be heard, and clearly that in that respect the tactics and strategies worked, insofar as it forced a discussion at much more significant levels, basically in the general population as well, to talk about this issue, because the members of parliament from the Conservative Party could not run away from them because they were consistently being disrupted, especially in the throughout the summer. I think what also was particularly inspiring is that those kinds of actions, I think, inspired other people who don't necessarily come from a healthcare provider background or who don't work in healthcare provision, but to take on, the similar campaign, basically, to oppose the cuts. The most notable example, potentially, was the disruption of a Jason Kenney talk at a fundraiser in Edmonton, Alberta, on July 15th, by Bashir Mohammed, who is a young guy who himself came as a refugee here when he was very, very young, and he's not a healthcare provider, but he was incredibly inspired and moved by the movement that was building, and he felt incumbent upon himself to also take action. And so I feel like we've been seeing those kind of splinter actions that have been happening along the way that have been really impressive, and also clearly shows that this issue goes beyond simple healthcare provision. It goes, you know, there's migrant justice activists who've been organizing around these issues for years, if not decades. And so it sort of broadens the scope of the resistance to these kinds of draconian measures by having people from all, you know, sort of all sectors of society weighing in on the issue.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned that example, though, because isn't it interesting that, you know, throughout the whole summer, physicians and different healthcare providers did interrupt ministers, but as far as I'm aware, that young man, who's a man of color, was the only one to be arrested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that speaks volumes on multiple levels. I think, you know, there's some people commented on having the white coat effect, you know, basically being protective, that people who did these disruptions with a white coat or had a stethoscope around their neck were protected because of the fact that they're professionals, which probably is true to a certain degree. But like you mentioned, the fact that this person was a racialized younger person, also in sort of what he described as, you know, being in the hornet's nest at a conservative fundraiser, sort of led to a situation where he was very forcefully and violently arrested, but with ultimately no charges being laid, because it was obviously completely preposterous. So yeah, that is definitely telling, and I think what was important for healthcare providers in that kind of a situation was to be able to denounce that from happening, and denounce the fact that that did happen, and to provide support not only in the case of Bashir, but also sort of making a more public call that people should feel comfortable to and encouraged to continue to disrupt events like that, so long as the cuts to the IFHP continue to persist.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to belabor this point too much longer, but I think it's really just interesting that you know, this mobilization really seems to have the spotlight seems to have been taken by people in shining white coats, and I just wonder, you know, there's a certain edge to that, right? The media is interested in that. The media is interested in the story of the healthcare worker who's, you know, never thought about this before, but all of a sudden is moved to act or to disrupt or to occupy an office. And I think when we look a bit deeper, we see that the healthcare workers that were engaged in those actions actually did have some history of organizing, and that they weren't necessarily, you know, they didn't all wake up one day and think, hey, like, you know, this is something we should do. Although obviously because of the numbers, there must have been some element of something that was very moving about this, this particular issue. But I just wonder if you can comment at all on that.
I mean, yeah, I think you're right. Like, I think the thing that we can't forget is that, like I was somewhat alluding to earlier, like, there have been, and you mentioned as well, you know, there have been people who've been organizing around these issues for a long time, and continue to do so. The fact that healthcare providers stepped up to the plate at this moment in time is welcome. But I think it'd be sort of an error in reading history to suggest that came out of a vacuum. Clearly, you know, many of these people have been organizing, have been sort of providing healthcare in this kind of setting for years. But I think there's all kinds of interactions that happen, including with migrant justice organizers who come from very different political perspectives. Often, you know, people coming from very sort of radical left perspectives that influenced the terrain to be able to allow for this kind of a mobilization to occur as well. And I think it's also somewhat risky to dichotomize things, because there are also healthcare providers who themselves come from that background, right? Mm-hmm. Who are completely politicized, who have been, who may in fact have gotten into healthcare completely informed by their politics, not simply, you know, for quote unquote humanitarian reasons of like wanting to help others, but mm-hmm. because they have a deep commitment to social justice and confronting injustice wherever it comes through, and they feel like healthcare provision is a vehicle through which to do that. So I think it's for sure, to a certain, you know, to a significant extent, is complex and complicated in that regard. But for me, you know, I think when things sort of expanded beyond the physician, you know, sort of a nucleus or a core of mostly physicians sort of doing disruptions and events or calling for rallies. To me, that was the moment that I thought was most interesting and has actually the most potential, because at that point in time, it goes beyond just healthcare providers, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps more importantly, people who have been dealing directly with whether it's healthcare cuts, but also more broadly speaking, with cuts to immigration or sort of draconian legislation that's passed through that has nefarious consequences. The people who deal with that are obviously the migrants themselves, and historically, the most inspiring examples of resistance to draconian cuts have come from people fighting deportations and detentions, or fighting for access to healthcare coming from that background, and I think that's continued. And I think, and I wonder, I mean, Bashir, for example, I'm just going back to that one example, but
mm-hmm.
I thought it was symbolic in that regard, because there was that element of this person having had that experience, having benefited from the IFHP himself as a refugee, and basically, very loudly and clearly stating that this is unacceptable to cut healthcare for other refugees who are coming. Clearly, it wasn't going to affect him anymore. He's a Canadian citizen or whatever. But the fact that the inherent injustice of the cuts, affected him to that degree, I think speaks to a significant extent. And I think in certain situations, especially when we talk about immigration, when there's such a level of precarity, because the stakes are so high, given that they are ultimately tied to detention and deportation, I think when other people who have more privilege in various ways are able to step up and take different, take up space, basically, that can shift the political terrain in ways that are actually very helpful and meaningful for people who are directly affected by these cuts to similarly be able to fight back, sort of when the time comes and they feel like they're able to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily imperil their well-being or their safety.
Mm-hmm. So in response to the cuts, a new group formed in Montreal, the Health Justice Collective, and you're part of that group. Can you tell me a little bit about what that group is about?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, many of us who ultimately ended up forming the collective had been talking, probably for years actually, about coming together to have a radical healthcare group that would be able to organize around different issues, not only around issues of migrant health, but things like harm reduction initiatives, health initiatives around trans health, Indigenous people, things like issues basically that we feel are not only important but are completely rooted in social realities and in politics that have disastrous consequences on people because of the kinds of policies that are implemented with respect to health. The fact that the IFHP cuts happened when they did ended up being a sort of a opportune, I guess, moment to come together more formally. And specifically, there was a certain level of frustration around that time. So this is like late June, early July. With the mobilization primarily led by physicians against the IFHP cuts, because there was a reticence that we felt at that time to discuss issues related to the to Bill C-31 at that time,
mm-hmm.
And to publicly publicly denounce the Conservative government. There seemed to be reticence based on the press releases we were seeing and things like that. I myself was involved in the June 18th National Day of Action mobilization component in Montreal, and that was definitely the feeling that I was getting, that there was a reticence to take on those two elements that for a lot of us seemed completely integral, to the cuts. And so we felt, as a group of folks involved in radical social justice movements for years, who also happen to work in healthcare, that We couldn't denounce the IFHP cuts without at the same time denouncing Bill C-31, but also putting a spotlight on immigration policy in general in Canada, rooting that in a history of other anti-immigrant legislation and policies from the last 100 to 150 years, and also recognizing what that means with respect to a history of colonization that's happened here and that's ongoing. So that's sort of where we were rooted, but the ultimate catalyst was really the fact that there was such a lack of willingness to denounce C-31 that we felt was integral to the IFHP cuts. And so we wanted to basically create some kind of a way to do that, to denounce those things by getting people to participate more actively, not necessarily simply just coming out to a rally or an action, which is obviously meaningful in its own right. But we thought having something interactive, having something where people who maybe work in remote areas would be able to participate, would feel sort of compelled to join in. And so that's when we decided to launch our We Refuse to Cooperate campaign, which is basically a call to healthcare providers, but not only healthcare providers, basically anyone who denounces the IFHP cuts and who also denounces the Bill C-31, to post up their picture on the internet with a message that clearly communicated their opposition to the IFHP cuts. And so we've basically held a launch event here in Montreal that was on July 5th that was quite well attended with regards to the media. We just held it at a park in a local neighborhood, which is kind of a mixed class, very diverse, racialized, with a lot of racialized communities living in that neighborhood, and so they made people basically came out, and we had like a photo booth session, encouraging people to take their pictures that we would post up on the internet, and people were also able to do that on their own time. Subsequent to that, other cities, including Toronto, London, and soon to be Hamilton, joined in similar initiatives, having launch events in their respective cities. So the campaign is ongoing. There's not necessarily an endpoint, except for the endpoint being the IFHP cuts would, to be rescinded. But it's been quite exciting actually to see the level of engagement, the level of involvement, and the sort of ripple effect, because we've gotten contacted by people from across the country in support of the initiative, and we continue to get requests to speak at events or to give interviews and whatnot to provide our perspective and our analysis on what we feel informs the cuts and what needs to be to confront them.
And do you want to let folks know about that website?
Yeah, so basically you can go and you can go to http collectifjusticesante, so collectifjusticesante.campagne, campagne.tumblr.com, and the instructions are on the website to be able to put up your own photo and with a message. And specifically, if there are people listening in different cities who are interested in having launch events, please don't hesitate to contact us. We can be reached by email at justice.sante@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter at justice.sante. So feel free to get in touch with us, and we can figure out logistics.
All right. Well, Samir, I want to thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Thanks for having me again, Nikki.
That was pediatrician and activist Dr. Samir Sahin Hussain. We reached him in Montreal. If you're interested in becoming more involved in the We Refuse to Cooperate campaign, you can join Hamiltonians for Migrant and Refugee Health at their event next Saturday, September 29th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Bayfront Park. I'll post the details on the Health Justice Radio website. It's www.healthjusticeradio.com. See you next week.